content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. The book was written 150 years ago, but has a premise so modern that it could have been written yesterday or tomorrow. A young woman named Alice Vavasor, who isn't rich, isn't particularly beautiful, and isn't really all that young. As the book opens, she's 24, which verged on old maidenhood in Victorian England, breaks off her engagement to a handsome, kind, and wealthy man because she's just not that into him. Most of her friends and relatives think she's nuts. The book was not the problem. We liked it a lot. All of us were within hailing distance of the heroine's age, and all but two of us were still single, so we sympathized with Alice's predicament and found it amazing that Trollope did too. As we discussed the novel, honeysuckle fluttered in the balmy air around us, wafting its sweet scent. And as we ate Megan's pasta with pesto and heirloom tomatoes, we happily agreed that the author was ahead of his time. The problem only popped up at dessert when we began chatting about what our next book should be. One member suggested The Portrait of a Lady, and without thinking, I blurted, "I hate that book," and began energetically explaining why its author, Henry James, was so much less fun to read than Trollope. Megan, our hostess, emphatically disagreed. Initially, the other members jumped into the conversation, dividing into two camps, one pro-Trollope, one pro-James. But as the battle raged on, the others gradually retreated from the fray, put off by the fierce tenor of the discussion. When Megan said outright that I was wrong, that The Portrait of a Lady was a very interesting book, and furthermore, that James was a better writer than Trollope, I didn't take offense. I just retorted, "Nuh-uh," and redoubled my defense of Trollope. I praised him for his strong female characters, attacked James for stuffiness and verbosity, and said I didn't understand how anyone could prefer James's stilted snobbery to Trollope's good-natured, inclusive energy. While Megan and I, who'd each grown up in outspoken families and were used to arguing and defending our points of view, continued heaving bombs across the table, one member of the group tried to clear plates and several others drew themselves deeper into their seats. I imagine that, like Alice's aunt in Can You Forgive Her, who recoiled when her niece voiced a harsh opinion, they jumped up with a little start at the vehemence of the words and of the tone in which they were expressed. But I admit I didn't notice. Finally, someone interrupted, proposing an Anne Tyler novel for our next gathering, putting an end to the debate. Quickly, we chose a less controversial book, Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, for our next session. But not as many members came to that one. Our numbers were cut in half, and the most ladylike members had defected en masse. Had they just gone off on their summer vacations, or had I spooked them? I wasn't sure. Recalling the James vs. Trollope showdown, I asked myself what had gone wrong. The main reason I had started book club the previous year was to increase and strengthen my female friendships. Before book club, I'd always had one or two close woman friends, but never what you might call a circle. When, as a sisterless little girl, I had joined Brownies, I had been daunted by their solidarity and mystified by their conversation. A couple decades on, I relished small talk and was much more sociable, but I still was a novice at group friend dynamics. Was there a tacit female social rule, I wonder, that decreed that everyone had to agree with one another, always, or they couldn't stay friends? If that's the case, I thought despairingly, our book group is doomed. When I turned to a friend in book club, who had lots of sisters, for advice on this question, I was relieved when she laughed. No group of women, even sisters, agrees on everything, she said. And she reminded me that our club had never been a rubber stamp. During our first year, we had not unanimously admired any of the books we'd chosen. We had different opinions about stories by Flannery O'Connor, about the Jane Austen novel Persuasion, and about The Red Tent, which was the first and last recommendation of my mother's that I ever dared push on book club. We were all entitled to our own points of view, she reassured me. But just because book club wasn't like The Stepford Wives didn't mean it should be like Fight Club. And I realized it wasn't a question of who liked Trollope versus who liked James. It was a question of who liked having their opinion derided and outshouted, which was nobody. We were young women then, in our 20s and 30s, in the early stages of building our careers. Our adult egos and professional reputations were still taking shape. Looking back, I remember those years as a time when we were all more porous, more vulnerable to criticism, and more sensitive to influence. And I believe we judged how well the world might one day treat us. That is, how well we deserve to be treated, by how well we treated each other in our self-selected literary society. None of us, except maybe Megan, despite her youth, had much authority in a workplace yet. But book club was a place where we got to be authorities to each other and to have our opinions heard, because we respected each other. Or that was the idea. In a funny way, I think an anti-authoritarian spirit had seized hold of me that day in Megan's Brooklyn garden. It may be a splash of class struggle, too. Her lovely backyard was so much more elegant than my plebeian urban cement patch in the East Village. When I took up against The Portrait of a Lady, I knew it was a favorite book of some of our members. I also knew that they had more intellectual tastes in literature than I did, and knew that James was considered more highbrow than Trollope. Yet a contrarian impulse made me want to joust. I believed in my right to my own opinion, not that it was right in some objective sense, but that it was worth defending if only because it was mine. It was not, however, I reflected, worth turning book club into a boxing match among friends who did not want to see the power struggles and insecurities of their office lives replay during their leisure hours. I realized that just because I had a thought didn't mean I had to shout it. I could think it, I could write it, I could say it, but I didn't need to express it in a way that made my friends feel attacked. And why bother to make an either-or case about any writer? Let's face it, I had liked the turn of the screw and what Maisie knew. In part, I really just preferred Trollope's characters to James's. Besides, it occurred to me, I already knew how I thought. Why not listen to how the others felt, so each of us could add to the constellation of ideas all of us had on a book or an author? In the book clubs that came after, I've tried to make sure every voice gets heard, that none is slighted, and that I check my tongue a bit. We haven't had any dust-ups since. Well, hardly any. Strangely, I found that this peaceable behavioral modification works very well outside of book club, too. At the office, among friends, even with family members, improving the way all of us get along. It amounts to a lessening of the urgency of I and a heightening of the instinct for us. There are still times when I feel inclined to contradict someone or to forcefully declare a contrarian view. When that happens, I remember book club and ruefully think of a Trollope novel I love called He Knew He Was Right, which of course is about a man who was very, very wrong. And when I see my book club around me these days, 24 of us still going strong after so many years, laughing, talking, hearing each other out, and disagreeing without acrimony, I feel so grateful. As Alice Vavasor said after she won the forgiveness of her friends, following her many senseless missteps, I am so happy. It is so much more than I have deserved. Our next article by Catherine May is titled, A New Mother's Voice Abandons Her. A year after I had my son, I lost my voice. I don't mean that I lost it altogether. Instead, it became weak and thin, trembling at the edges. If I spoke for any length of time, it would begin to crackle and then cut in and out like a faulty microphone. My throat tickled. I would cough ineffectually. Eventually, my throat would whistle into silence while I swallowed and drank water and fretfully tried to wrest it back into life again. I had navigated my entire life by talking, and suddenly my voice was unreliable. My speech was being chopped up, my words randomly erased. In everyday conversation with people I knew, I would talk until it faded and then wave my hand, hoping they could extrapolate the rest of what I meant to say. In the outside world, it was more difficult. I found myself blaming colds and sore throats that I didn't have without really knowing why I was lying. I suppose it was preferable to be seen as temporarily useless rather than feeling permanently so. Often in large groups of people I didn't know, I wouldn't speak at all. One of the greatest blows was that I could no longer sing. It's tempting to glibly write, not that singing played a huge part in my life, but that wouldn't be true. It may not be my profession or my ambition, but singing has sustained me for as long as I can remember, from attempting harmonies in the car with my mother to warbling along to the radio while I cook. I sang in choirs at school and at university, my low alto knitting with the other voices. Singing with others is a kind of alchemy, an act of expansive magic in which you lose yourself and become part of a whole. I have long been reliant on the stress release of booming out half-remembered choir parts when I'm driving alone in my car. The usual diagnoses did not apply. I had a camera inserted into my nose and pushed down my throat, and it found nothing. No polyps, no inflammation. Nothing that could be treated or cured. I had lost my voice, that was all. It was just something that had happened alongside all the other things that obliterated my sense of being a relevant presence in the world. When a friend suggested singing lessons, I laughed and said that really wasn't the most important thing. I had no intention of ever airing my voice in public again. But she said no, it wasn't about singing. She thought that a good teacher could help me to nurture my voice back into health and look after it in the future. Apparently, it happens all the time in the performing arts. Voices become frail and need restoring or remapping. My voice was an asset, and I should treat it in the way that other professionals did. Giving up was not an option. I sent a tentative email to a teacher explaining that I didn't really want to learn to sing per se, but instead to learn to talk again. I was surprised that he even replied, but he seemed to find my request entirely reasonable, although he did point out that I would have to sing. I thought that I could manage that. We agreed on a time and date. In the run-up, I wondered whether I actually could manage it. Newly unable to hit a single clean note and hold it, I was embarrassed to air my singing voice in public, and particularly in a room in which decent singers came to polish their style. But Philip, my tutor, struck me as a practical man. He said we should start with some basics, like standing and breathing. I cracked the joke, which I'm sure he'd heard a million times before, that I hopefully knew how to stand and breathe by now, but at that point I wasn't so sure if that were true. Standing and breathing felt far too much like the behavior of a steady, competent adult, one who had a place in the world. So I learned to make myself stable and to take air into my lungs, and then we tried to sing some scales. Philip played a middle C, and my voice glanced off it. "See," I said. It was a lost cause. "Try B," said Philip. I could sing B. The note was full of air, but I could hit it and the A below it. I worked my way down through the scale and back up it again and found that I could hit that C when it came after a burst of other notes. From then on, my scale started with an A or even a few notes below. Sometimes you need to take a few steps back and start somewhere else. Over the weeks that followed, we worked on getting the clarity back in my singing voice, the volume and precision of which I'd once been so proud. I learned to engage the muscles at the base of my throat and to imagine pulling an invisible thread forward as I sung to keep my voice originating from my lower larynx. I learned to flow one note into another to keep my song running like water. After my sessions, I didn't have the sore throat that I expected. I felt like a small part of my body had relaxed and that I expanded ever so slightly. I had sucked in the air around me and stopped being concave, pressed inward by life. After a couple of lessons, we fell into conversation about how I really use my voice. "Do you ever read your work aloud?" asked Philip. "Sometimes," I said, "not as much as I used to." The layers of truth hidden below that nobody asked me anymore, that I no longer really enjoyed the attention nor had the faith in my work, but that I nevertheless spent all day performing at work, dancing with other people's writing instead of my own, trying, sometimes in vain, to energize rooms of students who were already weighed down with their own thoughts and troubles. "Do you know Under Milkwood?" asked Philip, and I said that by coincidence I had a brand new copy sitting on my desk back at work, ready to support somebody's dissertation. Philip opened his copy and rested it on the music stand. "Read the first page," he said, and all over again my voice faltered. "It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent." I couldn't marshal my breath for those long, meandering sentences. In silence, I can understand them well enough, but aloud I stammered over them like a child learning to read. After I'd mangled, and all the people of the lulled and dumbbound town are sleeping now, Philip stopped me. "Listen," he said, and he read it himself, bouncing softly onto each stressed syllable, letting the words wash onto each other like waves on the sea. "You have to approach it like a song," he said. "Take your time. Don't attack it. Roll along with it." I tried again, shy this time, now that I had seen my own flaws so clearly. I thought I knew how to read aloud and read well, but I hadn't read this gentle, flowing text so much as dismantled it. I had gone at it like a thing to be conquered, and instead it had conquered me. It was shining a light on everything that was wrong in my life at that moment in time. I saw how I was locked in an attack on my immediate environment rather than merging into it. "Long Welsh vowels," said Philip, and that made things a little better. It was hard to elongate my own clipped Kentish phrasing without pastiching the accent, but we practiced individual words and the unhurried tone gradually fell into place. Hemming and bonnet and brooch and bombazine black, that final K clicking like a wet log on a warm fire. "Listen, it is night moving in the streets. Listen, it is night in the chill, squat chapel." When you start to use your voice as music, you are allowed to demand attention. You are allowed to say, "Listen." My voice had waned alongside my confidence, and asserting it again was like asserting my rightful part in the adult world. Within four lessons, I had remapped my voice, bringing it lower and louder and softer and slower. I had learned to almost sing my words, to let them elide into each other as a continuous river of notes, like birdsong. My middle C reappeared, but that didn't seem like the most important gain. When I spoke now, my voice felt smooth and slick, as though it had been oiled. It no longer tickled, it no longer broke. The words flowed back out of me like silk. But I was glad to sing again, too. It had been a greater loss than I'd realized in that particular wintering which saw the waning of my voice. The right to sing is an absolute, regardless of how it sounds to the outside world. We sing because we must. We sing because it fills our lungs with nourishing air and lets our hearts soar with the notes we let out. We sing because it allows us to speak of love and loss, delight and desire, all encoded in lyrics that let us pretend that those feelings are not quite ours. In song, we have permission to rehearse all our heartbreaks, all our lusts. In song, we can console our children while they are still too young to judge our rusty voices. And we could find shortcuts to ecstasy while performing the mundane duty of a daily shower or scrubbing down the kitchen after yet another meal. Best of all, we can sing together, whole families, knowing the same songs and giving them the same meaning. When I sing with my mother, I am struck every time that our voices are the same. There's a moment of deep genetic resonance in hitting the exact same note in the exact same way. When I sing with my husband, our voices clash, but we sing the songs that mean something only to us, most often the yearning tones of the Wichita lineman. When I sing with my son, I am teaching him something, not just words and lyrics, but how to survive. Like the robin, we sometimes sing to show how strong we are, and we sometimes sing in hope of better times. We sing either way. Excerpted from Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times, published by Riverhead Books, by Catherine May. Her new book, Enchantment, will be published on February 28, 2023, and is available to pre-order. Our next article by Martha Beck is titled, How Just-in-Time Thinking Can Help You Achieve Abundance. Shortly after World War II, executives at Japan's Toyota Motor Company made a decision from which I believe we all can benefit. They decided to make cars the way they'd make, say, sushi. Unlike most manufacturers, which bought and stored massive stockpiles of supplies, Toyota began ordering just enough parts to keep their lines moving, just when those parts were needed. This made them spectacularly productive and turned the phrase "just in time" into business legend. I know of the Toyota case because in my former life as an academic, I taught international business management. My students and I had some rousing discussions about just-in-time, or JIT, manufacturing, as well as its alternative, which is known as just-in-case, or JIC, inventory. These students were the first people who hired me as a life coach, perhaps because I could never resist applying business theory to everyday life. When we discussed JIT versus JIC management as a lifestyle strategy, we concluded that Toyota's business innovation could positively impact all of our lives. If you feel overburdened, overstressed, and anxious, I'm betting the same is true for you. Why just in case is just crazy? Most people live with a just-in-case mindset because for most of human history, it made sense. The primary fact of life for just-in-case processes is everything good is scarce. By contrast, just-in-time systems rely on the assumption everything good is readily available. Well, until quite recently, the former claim was true for most humans. It's still true for many. But most magazine readers like you live in settings where basic necessities like food, clothing, and other humans are plentiful. Living in an abundant environment but operating on the assumption that good things are scarce leads to a host of dysfunctions that can be summed up in one word, excess. Most of us are living in some kind of excess. We work too much, eat too much, rack up debt buying too much stuff. Yet, driven by the unconscious, just-in-case assumption that everything good is scarce, we just keep doing and accumulating more. We've all seen some of the unfortunate results, and I found that most fall into the following four categories. Number one, starving off the fat of the land. For years, I noticed that my clients who lived in a mindset of scarcity had trouble controlling their weight, even though they dieted assiduously. I also read studies showing that poor women, particularly those who periodically starved themselves to feed their children, were particularly plagued by obesity. Researchers hypothesize that when the body knows it may be starved, whether by poverty or by dieting, it activates automatic just-in-case mechanisms that store fat on the body to get through the next famine. Ironically, this biological just-in-case mechanism puts fat on precisely the people with the discipline to starve themselves. Number two, stuff tsunamis. Just-in-case thinking triggers primal unconscious impulses to hoard good stuff, fat supplies being just one example. Combine JIC attitudes with a superabundant culture, and things can go wildly off kilter. There have been several cases, like the one in Shelton, Washington, where a woman recently suffocated under a pile of her own possessions. To recover her body, police reported having to climb over clutter on their hands and knees. In some areas, their heads were touching the ceiling while they were standing on top of piles of debris. Number three, money madness. My wealthiest clients have taught me that having lots of money doesn't quiet scarcity-based JIC anxiety. This point was reinforced for me when I heard about the suicide of the German billionaire who lost hundreds of millions of dollars in the recent financial crisis. Now, this poor guy wasn't literally a poor guy. He still had a personal fortune. But to a just-in-case thinker who's used to billions, it wasn't enough to keep him from throwing himself in front of a train. Number four, love's labor's lost. Just-in-case thinking destroys relationships faster than, and sometimes with the assistance of, a speeding bullet. Along with the impulse to hoard objects, it also triggers excessive attempts to control our supply of love, that is, other people. So anxious lovers have their partners followed. Parents micromanage children. People pleasers try to manipulate everyone into liking them. This behavior isn't love. It's a fear-based outcome of believing love is scarce. If you've ever been on the receiving end of such anxious machinations, you know they make you want to run, not bond. Why just in time just makes sense? As Toyota execs and my graduate students concluded so many years ago, hanging on to a just-in-case worldview in abundant environments is plain bad business. And as I've seen in countless coaching scenarios since, switching to a just-in-time mindset, everything good is readily available, restores health and balance to our lives. The great news is that just one mental shift, focusing on the abundance of your environment, switches your psychological settings so that your life automatically improves in many areas you may think are unrelated. This is essentially a leap from fear to faith. It's not religious faith, but the simple belief that we'll probably be able to get what we need when we need it. When the issues above are considered through abundance-based, just-in-time thinking, it's a whole different ballgame. Food fulfillment. I've never been a weight loss coach. My focus is on helping people go from fear and suffering to relaxation and happiness, So I was baffled when many of my clients told me, "I'm finally losing weight and I'm not even trying." This intrigued me so much that I spent years researching and writing a book about it called The 4-Day Win. After reading thousands of studies and interviewing dozens of experts, I'm convinced that the thought, "everything good is readily available," kicks the body out of its panicky fat storing mode and into a state that helps it shed excess fat. Stuff sufficiency. Diane is 50-ish and newly divorced. Part of our coaching work helped her develop just-in-time confidence about money, which allowed her to leave the financial security of her emotionally dead marriage. During our final session, she said, "Something weird is happening. All of a sudden, I'm tidy. I've always been a stuff person, but now I don't add clutter. It's a wonderful, spacious feeling." Diane didn't achieve this by forcing herself to clean up. She simply developed the confidence of a just-in-time manager, and her behavior changed almost on its own. Mellow money management. "I got really panicky when the economy went south," says Jackie, one of my fellow coaches. "All my business dried up and I was really scared. But I hate feeling scared and I'm a coach, so one day I coached myself back to trusting life. I felt better immediately, but what's strange is that clients started coming out of the woodwork. I had to start a waiting list." This, as any Toyota alum will tell you, is what happens to people who have enough confidence to run a just-in-time operation. I can't quite explain this. It often seems nothing short of miraculous. Perhaps this is why the authors of the Bible included the story of the wandering Israelites who were given manna from heaven, but only permitted to gather enough to supply their needs until the next manifestation. Whether you take it literally or metaphorically, this tale was considered important enough to become holy writ. Why? I believe it's to counteract the just-in-case anxiety that makes billionaires keep hoarding more money. The Israelite story keepers wanted to remind readers that, miraculous as it seems, just-in-time confidence keeps supply lines clear and prosperity flowing. Lasting love. I've done my share of just-in-case controlling when it comes to love. I'd like to apologize to anyone who once wandered into my danger zone. Happily, I've learned that setting people free, not trying to control them, ensures a lifetime supply of love. Here's the closest thing I know to a genuine love spell. "I'll always love you, and I really don't care what you do." This is not a promise to stay in a relationship with someone whose behavior is destructive. It's a simple statement that you aren't dependent on the other person's choices. That means you can respond to someone as he or she really is instead of trying to force a fallible person to be infallible. Knowing that love, like all good things, is readily available, we don't need to control any individual. And oh, how people love being loved without a care. Making the switch. When I meet someone who's a mess of excess, I just itch to coach them. I know that if they'd reroute a few simple brain habits, their lives would improve almost effortlessly. The transformation wouldn't take much work. No need to exhume childhood traumas or hook up an antidepressant IV. We just throw the neurological toggle switch that exchanges flight or fight mode, the sympathetic nervous system, for rest and relaxation mode, the parasympathetic nervous system. Most animals experience this switch in response to environmental conditions. We humans possess an unparalleled ability to create it with our thoughts. It's almost too easy. Simply by taking your attention off thoughts of scarcity and persistently focusing on observations of abundance, you can replace the nervous, just-in-case mindset that kept our ancient forebears alive but is killing many of us. The best way to affect this shift is to use these simple exercises. 1. List 10 times you thought there wouldn't be enough of something and you survived. 2. List 10 areas where you have too much, not too little. 3. List 20 or 50 or 1,000 wonderful things that entered your life just at the right time with no effort on your part. Start with the little things: oxygen, sunlight, a song on the radio. You'll soon think of bigger ones. Most of my clients realize that the most important things in their lives showed up this way. I started doing exercise 3 several years ago, and I still haven't finished my list. Once you deliberately focus on abundance, you'll be overwhelmed by all the good things that show up like manna in the desert without much effort on your part. If this seems too easy, you can go back to fearful just-in-case thinking, You'll need a diet counselor, a housekeeper, and a financial planner, but that's okay. They can substitute for friends. But if, like me, my business school students and my clients, you decide to try just-in-time thinking, you'll find yourself struggling less and accomplishing more in ways you'd never expect. You may kick yourself for not discovering this sooner. Relax. I promise you're just in time. Our next article by Rebecca Gumier is titled Cooper's Heart. Years after the loss of her son, a coincidental meeting upended everything this writer knew about life, death, faith, and the thread that connects us all. In human gestation, the precursor of the heart, called the heart tube, forms in a region known as the cardiogenic field. On or around the 23rd day, tracing the path of some invisible template, the multiplying cells begin a right looping arc, developing in the form of a spiral as would a rose or a seashell or a galaxy. More than 40 years ago, Spanish cardiologist Francisco Torrent Guas, using his gloved fingers, separated the tissue of a bovine heart at the naturally occurring juncture where the ventricular myocardial band circles around to meet itself. He unfurled the organ, spreading it out flat, a reminder that while for centuries science has continued to treat the heart as a four-chambered construct, there is an added dimension. The heart is also an elegant Gordian knot of one continuous muscle that with each beat contracts and relaxes, pumping blood out and allowing it back in. In the course of one day, the adult heart will beat more than 86,000 times. In one year, more than 31 million times. By age 70, a human heart will have logged upwards of 2.3 billion contractions, taking cues from the electrical impulses that move through it like lightning up a staircase. Even the heart of a baby who lives just 42 days will pulsate more than 6 million times before its final fluttering beat. "Are you ready?" asked the pathologist. I nod, making a chalice of my hands, and he reaches down into the plastic bucket and lifts my son's heart and lungs out of the water. I feel a slight weight, as if I am holding a kitten or a bird. I blink, and the world turns sideways beneath me. Cooper was born on a Sunday morning in October 1982. In every way, his arrival was ordinary. He was delivered after 8 hours of labor. Following his first breath, he let out a sharp, lusty cry, his body turning a healthy pink as oxygen moved through his bloodstream. He scored high marks on the standard Apgar newborn assessment. The pediatrician observed that his 6.5-pound birth weight contrasted with that of our first child, Liam, born weighing nearly 9 pounds, but she did not appear concerned and made no further comment. That evening, a report came on about a tropical storm that had hit the coast of Central America. Watching the grainy footage of tearing waves and flailing trees, I felt a wrenching, not of physical origin, but something deeper, more terrifying, so that my breath came in short bursts. I turned off the television and pushed away the dinner tray. I was being silly, I told myself. Hormones and exhaustion, I thought. That night, Cooper fell asleep partway through his feeding, his mouth working the air for a brief moment before he sank into the crook of my arm. The nurse said some babies need encouragement and suggested I uncover his feet. On the second day after his circumcision, Cooper stayed in my room and nursed a little and slept, nursed and slept again. The nurse said he was probably worn out from the procedure. On the morning of the third day, as we packed to go home, our pediatrician stopped by to say she was hearing a little heart murmur. She suggested we take Cooper to the children's hospital to see her friend, a pediatric cardiologist. She said murmurs are common, that nearly half of all newborns have them. She did not seem overly concerned. "Just to give a listen," she said, signing the discharge papers. The cardiologist, a trim man who looked to be in his early 40s, met us in the hospital lobby. We followed him into the elevator and up 2 floors to his office, where he performed a brief examination, narrowing his eyes as he listened to our son's heart. Then he draped the stethoscope around his neck and with a quick smile told us he'd like to get some x-rays. We followed him down a hall and into a room where 2 technicians were waiting. One took Cooper and held him while I removed his clothing, leaving him in his diaper. She placed him on a small saddle with his arms above his head, while a hard plastic case was fastened around his torso, holding him there like the tiny victim of a stick-up. He wailed furiously. We watched from a window in the next room as the X-ray machine swiveled around him, capturing images from numerous angles. After the X-rays, he was taken for an ultrasound. This time, my husband and I sat holding hands in the waiting area. It's probably nothing, we assured each other. They're just being cautious, we agreed. When at last we sat in the cardiologist's office, he placed a chair across from us so that his knees almost touched ours. He held a notepad in one hand, a pen in the other. We moved forward to see what he was drawing, to listen as he deciphered the blue scrawls filling the empty page. "Do you know what a heart looks like?" he asked, and I remembered having one distinct thought. We should run. Outside in the bright October day, traffic hummed along as if everything were normal, as if I were not holding a baby whose blood pressure was at once too high and too low, blood backed up in some vessels like a clogged river, slowing to a trickle in others, whose aorta narrowed to the width of a sewing thread just below the heart, whose lungs were compressed by his enlarged right atrium and ventricle. Early the next morning, we returned to hand him over again, this time to a lion of a man with massive hands and a mane of graying reddish hair, a pediatric heart surgeon who, while we paced like animals in a crowded waiting room awash in the smells of French fries and cigarette smoke and body odor, would make a long, delicate incision in our son's small torso, beginning just under the sternum and traversing the left side of his body around to the back, removing the scalpel just under the left shoulder blade. He would pull back the flesh and uncover the mistake, cut out the narrowed section and resect the aorta so blood would flow unimpeded and pressure would stabilize, and the small heart that had been working so hard could ease into a sure and steady rhythm. 6 hours later, the surgeon came to find us. "Everything went fine," he said. I wept into his broad chest. In the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, there was neither night nor day, but another kind of time altogether. In a far corner of that too bright room was a plastic bassinet, and inside lay Cooper, his eyes wide with shock and pain. 4 days later, my husband and I were able to hold him. The next day, I was able to nurse him. When we brought him home on the 10th day, he had already gained a pound, and once he was in a regular feeding routine, he was able to sleep. His cheeks grew round, and he kicked his legs in excitement. I let myself breathe. On an overcast morning in early December, Cooper, now 6 weeks old, woke fretful and vomited after his morning feeding. My husband was away on a business trip, so I dropped off Liam at a friend's and took Cooper to our pediatrician. She gave him a thorough examination, listening intently to his heart, his lungs, his pulse points, all she said sounding normal. She thought he had likely picked up a virus and prescribed electrolyte fluids and rest. Back home, he continued to fuss, ate little, and toward evening had a short bout of diarrhea. After Liam was in bed, I called my husband, who was preparing to board his overnight return flight. We chatted about his pre-dawn arrival and the trip he'd been on, anything to avoid naming our fear. Then I sat in the quiet house and listened to the ticking mantel clock and rocked Cooper, and after a time he quieted and was able to take a little fluid, and we both dozed in the chair. Then this. He wakes, fussing, squirming. I change his diaper and notice he is cool, so cool to the touch, and his skin has gone white, his surgical scar now a harsh purple line against his pale torso. And then, I'm on the phone with the pediatrician, hating to bother her because it is nearly 11 at night, hating to be so inept, but I tell her about this new thing, this coolness, and she says, "Try putting him in a warm bath and see if that doesn't help." So I do, and it calms us both, but now I cry too, afraid and very tired, and I talk to him between my fits of weeping, saying, "There, isn't that nice? Doesn't that feel good? Aren't you better?" He lies in the tub without kicking or moving, looking up at me. I listen to his quiet breathing and watch his dark eyes watching me. I dry him off and dress him in a pine green fleece romper and tuck him inside a cotton flannel receiving blanket, and then wrap a crocheted afghan around him. I bring him downstairs and rock him some more. Now he sleeps, but I am unsettled. His face feels so cool. I call the pediatrician again. Okay, she says, let's put him back in the hospital till he gets over this, and tells me she will meet us there. I call my neighbor Jerry to come take Liam to their house. I call my sister-in-law to come with me to the hospital. I put Cooper on the sofa. I notice his lungs sound congested, and this is concerning. This rattling sound is new. But he is resting at last, so I lay him next to a cushion and run upstairs to pull Liam from his bed, and he is sleeping so hard he cannot wake up. His legs buckle. He's just 2 years old, but I struggle to hold up his dead weight as I try to dress him. I carry him downstairs, where I place him on the shag carpet and slide his arms into his winter jacket, stuff his limp feet into his boots, pull his hat onto his head. He sleeps through it all. My neighbor arrives. I'm saying things like the baby and my sister-in-law in the hospital. Everything is whirling. And then in an instant, I feel a terrible pulling inside me. I let Liam slide to the floor and look across the room at Cooper. He's not breathing, I say, and I know it's true. What? Jerry is confused. He's not breathing. I run to the sofa, peel away the layers, unzip the fleece, draw up his undershirt, lay my ear to his cool chest. All I hear is the thud of my own heart. I take a deep breath, lift my head, place it on his chest again. Call 911, I shout, and then everything has changed. I hold him, panicked, try to breathe into his mouth, try to push on his small chest, but I don't know what I'm doing. So instead I rock him and I whisper because I have no voice. Please, God, not my baby, not my baby. Please don't take my baby. The door bangs open. For a moment, there's confusion. At first, the EMTs go to Liam, asleep on the floor, thinking he is the one in distress. I cannot speak, hunched over Cooper, trying to breathe for both of us. Over here, yells Jerry. They take Cooper from me, put him on the dining room table, a table I will later have to give away. They listen and look and listen some more for a long time with grim faces. At last, one of the paramedics pronounces what we all know. This baby is deceased. A sob escapes from one of the squad members, a young dark-haired man, and he wipes his eyes. I'm so sorry, he says. My husband arrives home sometime before 4 in the morning. I meet him at the door. He sees my face, and behind me are a pastor and the pediatrician and friends and neighbors, and he shakes his head, saying no and refusing to come inside, putting his hand out and saying no, no, no. Then his legs give way and he falls to his knees. We kneel together on our front porch, first light creeping from the east. When the coroner arrives, my husband and I hold our baby and stroke the blanket covering his small, cold body. We kiss his forehead and tell him we love him, and we hand him over one last time. Since he has died at home, an autopsy is mandatory. We are devastated to think of him being cut open again, but we have no say in the matter, and we sign the papers, allowing the hospital to do what it must. Liam sits next to me on the sofa and asks again where the baby is gone, and I tell him again that the baby was very sick, and it was a kind of sick that couldn't get better. But it's not a kind of sick you can catch. You are fine. But the baby was sick, and the baby died, and now he is in heaven with God. I tell Liam God is taking good care of our baby, but I am not sure I believe it. Not sure at all. I want God to be real. I need there to be someone in charge, and I need there to be a heaven, someplace where I know my baby is safe and cared for and loved. I think back to when I was a child, moments when I sensed a presence. At 8, seated between my mother and sister in a church pew, the sun painting my leg in reds and golds and blues, believing God was somehow in that dance of color. At 12, perched on a hillside as a wild wind stirred, then quieted in the field behind me. And then in the utter stillness came the piercing call of one lone bird, sending chills over my skin, the very voice of God in my ear. Where are you now, I wonder? Friends from a Bible study I've recently joined come to sit with me, read Psalms, offer prayers against the descending darkness. Where are you now? Sometimes late in the afternoon when Liam is napping and the house is quiet, I hear a baby's cries coming as if from some distant room. I startle each time before I remember what my doctor has told me. that these are phantom cries common with women who have lost a child. In time, the phantom crying ceases. I clean Cooper's room and box up his clothing, keeping his cotton hospital blanket and a small stuffed bear, and some days I sit in the rocker and hold them close to me. 6 months later, I am pregnant again. My husband and I are terrified at the thought of another loss, and we know this baby will not replace the one who died. And yet there is an urgency toward more life, our arms aching and empty. When Maggie is born, healthy and lively, I am filled with joy and fear. I am on my guard, so if she starts to slip away, I can snatch her back. This time I will be ready. I worry Maggie will suffocate while I nurse her. After she finishes, I put her on my chest where she falls asleep. I stay awake and count every breath until the birds begin to stir and I know we have made it through another night. I worry, too, that Liam will catch something fatal. My stomach aches and sometimes I feel dizzy and far away. My church friends tell me to trust God. They tell me they are praying for me. But Maggie doesn't die, and spring comes, and she is robust and round. And when her brother makes her laugh, a tiny dimple appears in her right cheek. Then it is another year and another, and I am forgetting altogether about dusting the pictures of Cooper on the mantle. By this time, Liam is in kindergarten, and Maggie is in daycare. Now also, faint fault lines begin to show in our marriage's foundation. Grief is the uninvited third party that has refused to leave. All the while, I attend my Bible study class. I am on a mission now, poring over the scriptures, looking for clues, patterns, a key that unlocks the secret door to the place that holds the answers I seek. At the end of the class, I am still searching. It is early fall when I enter seminary. I am part scholar, part detective, both parts waiting to be struck like Paul on the road to Damascus, knocked face down in the dust, then renamed, remade, given new eyes to see some revelation of God woven in the very fabric of the universe. I find I'm good at constructing the theological system. There is a certain satisfying logic to the if-then sequences that I'm able to make solid in my academic essays. I falter, though, when a friend with headaches is diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor that will take her from her three young children in a couple of years. I lose my footing when a local teen shoots himself one night while sitting on the seminary steps, and we come to class the next day to find his blood puddled on the pavement. I can barely stand to watch the devastation on TV. It seems the world is unraveling at its center. I learn Hebrew, deciphering from right to left the cryptic marks on the page, and wait for something to be revealed. I parse Greek sentences, looking for the meaning behind the meaning. I read the desert fathers and mothers, peering through their eyes at ancient sunrises, trying with them to see beyond the far horizon. I study the systematic theologians, listen to their conclusions, weigh and measure them against what I know about babies who slip away in the night. Always with the same question, where are you now? 7 years after Cooper's death, I begin the supervised chaplaincy I would need to complete in order to be ordained. In our city, there are several possible sites, 4 hospitals, an addiction treatment center, and 2 nursing care facilities. One of the sites is the Children's Hospital. Many who choose it quit the program before completing it, crushed by the horror of suffering and dying children and their own terrible helplessness in the face of it. I had driven past this hospital each day on my way to the seminary and never without a stab of sadness, recalling Cooper's tiny form in the bassinet in the corner of the NICU, where the babies were too sick to cry. Since he died, I had been there only once to visit an ailing niece, and that day I could barely make it through the front doors. Having counseled me through my ongoing crisis of faith, my advisor strongly suggests I cross the site off my list. I know he has good intentions. Still, I feel an overwhelming urge to apply there. I can't explain it, I tell him as he shakes his head, but I feel like a fish being reeled in. On a blustery day in January, I begin the 20-week program and am assigned to work with children who have infectious diseases, mostly serious respiratory infections and AIDS. I am placed on the Saturday night on-call rotation, which means spending most weekends tethered to my pager in the emergency room. During the first week, several children die on my watch. A house fire takes a 3-year-old boy. An aneurysm kills a 4-year-old boy. Meningitis ravages the body of a 7-year-old boy. A 5-year-old girl riding without a seatbelt is catapulted through a car's windshield. I'm frequently called up to the NICU. I lose weight, unable to eat more than a few bites at a time, and become exhausted and frequently ill from sleepless overnight shifts, the days and nights bleeding into one another. While I offer prayers for and consolation to frightened children and shattered parents, my raging conversations with God continue, shared only with my colleagues and supervisor. As part of our instruction, we gather weekly for training with various hospital staff. Halfway through the program, we are visited by a pathologist, a soft-spoken older man who has come to talk with us about the autopsy procedure. Toward the end of the session, he passes around a photocopy of a sample autopsy form, and at the bottom of the page is a familiar signature. This is the man who performed my son's autopsy. Later that day, I go to the morgue and ask for an appointment. I want to know more. I want to know anything I can know. The pathologist asks me to come back the next day when he will be better prepared to meet with me. The following afternoon, he shows me into a conference room, sits me at the large table where he has placed Cooper's full autopsy report, and goes over it, page by page, translating every detail and stopping to answer each of my questions. When he closes the binder, he turns to me and begins explaining his role in training medical students and his special area of interest, the heart-lung system, describing how he procures and preserves the organs during the autopsy to use them in teaching, injecting them with dye so students can see where problems have occurred and how repairs might be made. He is quiet for a long moment and then says, "I still have your son's heart and lungs. Do you want to see them?" Is it odd to be joyful in such a moment? Do you think it unseemly that my own heart leaps, that I feel an indescribable elation, the breath in me suddenly expansive? In the brightly lit morgue, the pathologist and I draw on latex gloves and move together to a stainless steel sink where water is running into a white plastic bucket. Reaching down into the bucket, he brings up all that remains of my son, and in the next instant, I hold in my hands the heart that had been inside the infant who had been inside of me. I peer at the small, gray, mismatched lungs and examine the stitches on the aorta, stitches that were sewn in nearly 2,700 days before, while his father and I sat in the waiting room, holding on to each other when we still knew how. As I cradle my son's organs, the doctor uses one gloved finger to open the dissected heart, showing me the holes in the septum, the wall between the two atria. "Here and here and here," he says, pointing. And I stare at each in turn, at the defects that in 1982 had been undetectable in our 3-day-old infant, yet powerful enough to kill him. I stand there for I don't know how long, breathing in the faint odor of formalin, trying to see what I am seeing. So unreal does it seem that I actually stand holding my son's remains. At some point, I begin to do a new thing, to move beyond grief and guilt into wonder, to celebrate what I was part of creating, not what was lost, but what was alive, what moved and pulsated deep inside of me, what seems to be in some way part of me still. After a while, I hand my son's organs back to the pathologist, who lowers them into the bucket, where they float like rare creatures of the sea. Do I believe God led me there to find Cooper's heart? Yes. No. I don't know. What is God anyway? I'm no longer certain if I ever was. Over the years, visited again by loss of my marriage, parents, dear friends, I step past the boundaries that seek to define where God resides and move beyond ordained service, beyond church, dancing now along the far borders of what might be called faith. Here's what I can attest to. I went into a hospital basement broken in certain places and returned mended, restored. I went there thinking I knew what I knew, autopsy report in hand, and discovered I knew next to nothing at all, for here my son had been all along, teaching. And here was my answer. There is no answer. But there is love, the kind that binds us to each other in ways beyond our knowing, ways that span distance, melt time, rupture the membrane between the living and the dead. I like to imagine we are all us part of a many-chambered construct that love is continually building, its glimmering hallways winding in and around us, and from time to time an unheard sound comes from another room, noiseless, beyond our comprehension, received as a tug, a whirring in our heads, a flicker in a dream, a vibration along the invisible thread that connects us. We are troubled, we are stirred, and we are not certain why, but something in us answers. We'll end this week with four quotes that will inspire you to be a force for change by Adrienne Farr. In this week's intention, Oprah expressed her concern for the nation and wondered what would happen if something wasn't done to preserve democracy. Below, inspiring words that will keep you focused on doing your part. I have one life and one chance to make it count for something. My faith demands that I do whatever I can, wherever I am, whenever I can, for as long as I can, with whatever I have to try to make a difference. Jimmy Carter. Good trouble is simple. When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have a moral obligation. You have a mission. You have a mandate to speak up, to speak out. John Lewis. No matter how honest and decent we are in our private lives, if we do not have the right kind of law and the right kind of administration of the law, we cannot go forward as a nation. President Theodore Roosevelt. Change will not come if we wait for some other person or some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Barack Obama. John Lewis. No matter how honest and decent we are in our private lives, if we do not have the right kind of law and the right kind of administration of the law, we cannot go forward as a nation. President Theodore Roosevelt. Change will not come if we wait for some other person or some other time. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Barack Obama. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.